That's Oceanside. Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Roach, and I'm so grateful tonight that I'll probably be disgusting. What a wonderful week this has been. And I've been hearing so many wonderful things from all of you that I have no idea what I'm going to talk about tonight. I just have my head swimming with wonderful messages. All I'd hear these, oh, I got to remember that one. And then I don't know if you're like that. You know, I'll remember it later and I don't know where I heard it. But I just my heart is full. And I hope a lot of you feel the same way being up here. I'm impressed with the new recruits. This is not an easy kind of thing to get started in, I'll tell you. You can get whooshed in, but it's kind of fun to be at something like this. It's also, in our area, sometimes we register people, well, often we do, on our little registration forms. It says AA, Al-Anon, Alateen, or Other. Not significant other, just Other. And we had a friend for years who's, he was married to an alcoholic lady, and he always said, I'm a real good other. I practice a good other program. He never told us what that was. So he was happy with that. But sometimes being an other around here doesn't get comfortable. After a while, you're uncomfortable. You want to be one of us. And I'm just so happy. Those of you who heard my husband Monday night don't need to know that I'm just endlessly grateful that his silly little disgusting sponsor dragged me into Al-Anon. Because you see, I didn't come to Al-Anon for help. Because I came to help you. And and this man that he'd gone back into AA one more time. And frankly, those experiences when he'd been in before were much worse than when he was drinking. And the kids used to say, my God, give him a drink, you know. And so my feeling about you people was, for one thing, some of you weren't the kind of people I wanted him associating with. And I was a little concerned about the influence that would have on our children. And then he goes and gets this weird little sponsor. He lived around the street. His name was Bill Blake. Bill was married to Margie, who they were both AA members. Margie was great, but Bill, he had no manners whatsoever. He had been sober 8 years, and because he lived around the corner, he would pop in my house all the time, uninvited, never rang the door. Well, the doorbell didn't work. That's a little alcoholic story that goes with that. I won't even bother you with it. And he didn't knock. All of a sudden, I'd be in the kitchen, and there he'd be standing there with these pamphlets saying I should go to Al-Anon. And I would say, well, okay, Bill, thanks very much, but I was a psychology major, you see. And of course, you know what good that had done me by then, but that's where my head was. And he was rude, and he'd just come in like a little banty rooster, and he's all over the place. And then I began going to meetings with Cliff and Bill and Margie to keep track of this kind of thingy. Now, what's he gotten me into? And I'm telling you, my early experiences were questionable. For one thing, Bill kept talking about this wonderful speaker named Chuck C. And he was so spiritual. And he was just somebody we should all hear. And he would say to me, and Margie even would, and this you'll really hear the program. Well, the first time I heard Chuck talk, he was imposing. Tall man, this is 35 years ago, and he was in his prime. And he'd say something, and if you've ever heard his tapes, and then he goes, he. What's this spiritual stuff? And then the second well-known speaker I met was Bill's sponsor, who was Clancy I from Up in the Sky. And and I went with them to, the first time I did this, I went with them to Clancy's at then backyard on Saturdays. It still is the same backyard. And there were a lot of people there. And they weren't my kind of people. And Clancy, first thing he said to me when I met was something that Cliff said the other night was, oh, were you sitting in a gutter waiting for an alcoholic to come along and abuse you? You know, that, which Cliff is delighted to have heard that, so he grabbed that one. And then he took me in to meet his wife, Charlotte, who loves animals, and I do. And so I kind of liked his wife, and that helped. But in this backyard, they had this, some of you have been there, I'm sure, they had this Saturday routine. They played softball across the street at the school, and then they came over and they had lunch. Now, these people, these sober people, and their Al-Anon spouses, would all vie for the position of who gets to clean up the dog poop. This was their goal. I mean, this is they really, that was an honor. And this is the kind of stuff he was getting me into. But I had to stick around a little bit because I needed to keep track of what on earth now he was into. And then there was this woman, Mary Ann Kay. Some of you know Mary Ann. Mary Ann was new. And according to my memory, which may or may not be accurate, he says, his life becomes what I tell him it was, and I tell him I knew what was going on, but you know, who knows? But this is probably pretty close to the truth. They were playing volleyball in the backyard, and Marianne was brand new, and everybody was fawning over her, and just she was treating her like she was some kind of a princess. And she would loudly announce, and so would nobody seem to be bothered by it, that she'd been a very successful hooker. I don't know to this day whether Marianne, I know Marianne very well today now, I just love her, but Marianne was playing volleyball and she had on this great big long t-shirt, and that's all she had on. She's playing volleyball. So nobody wanted to be on her side, they wanted to be on the other side. And that's my experience. So I knew I had to keep an eye on him, and so I was an other for a couple of months. And if there are people here who are an other, or who are a spouse of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who call themselves an Al-Anon, shame on you. You know, we work the steps and we go to meetings and we do our own thing, and you're missing something. You're really missing something. It isn't that there isn't value in coming to an AA meeting and hearing those steps. And of course, I also became quite fond of Chuck and his wife and Clancy and his wife, and I learned a whole lot to get over that and to be able to see the wonderful people they really are. But I wasn't working on myself, of course, because I was very busy hearing this great program of recovery and recognizing some of the value and seeing that he did it. And I certainly knew when he didn't. And I reported to his sponsor. And Bill just, you know, said, okay, you know, I don't know. I didn't get very far. He never told me not to do that. He just said, okay, thanks for sharing, or whatever he said. And then one day, and this was St. Patrick's Day of 1970. And it's very important to me because besides the fact that I was a miserable, sick pre-Al-Anon, I had married a member of the CIA. That's the Catholic Irish Alcoholic, for those of you who don't know. And boy, I didn't know much about that, I'll tell you. So our St. Patrick's Days had been, well, let's say the least thing I could say about them is they were interesting. And because he is half Irish and everybody in town became Irish at his invitation. And our house was filled with Irishmen. Some of them weren't the color of Irishmen, but they were all there. And I, of course, being the person I was, I'm fixing all the cabbage. I mean, I fed hundreds of people. And just, you know, I made the sacrifices. And, and you'll hear this theme, I'll tell you. So it's very significant to me that it was on St. Patrick's Day when we were not having a party. First time since I'd known him. And it was a Wednesday. And Bill came in and he did not, he knocked on the door. That surprised me in the first place. And he didn't say anything to me about I needed Al-Anon help. Instead, he sat me down very quietly and he said, you know, I checked out the Al-Anon meeting until we had 1.5 meetings in our city in Oceanside then. The half being you never knew if anybody's going to show up, you know. And he said, you know, I really think they could use your help. And he was smart enough to know to tell me that on the night of the day of a meeting. And I was there that night. Because he had observed, he said, how well organized I was. And I was. I mean, I was impressive. And he knew that. And so I came to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I could see right away you did need some organizational help. You even had these traditions up there that say, we're not organized. I mean, you're bragging about it. So I felt like I had found another place in my life where I could be of service. And to the great benefit, those wonderful, wonderful Al-Anons, there weren't that many in there, 12, something like that. They never told me they didn't need help, but I did. They never did. They said, oh, we're so glad you're here. We really need you. And, of course, they were telling me that in a way that they knew what they meant. And I thought they meant something quite different, you know. And one old woman, and she was probably younger than I am today, but her name was Millie. And she was a militant Millie. And she didn't sponsor particularly people in the group, but she sponsored anybody who came. They got it. And I was able to see later, right away, saw what kind of person I was. And she said, you know, you look like somebody who could help us out next week. This is what got me back there, folks. And she said, would you mind standing at the door and greeting newcomers? Now, this is meeting with 12 people, and we maybe got a newcomer every month or so, I don't know. But I didn't know that then. And I said, oh, sure, I was in a sorority, and I know about receiving lines. Millie never forgot that, by the way. So I did what she said, because I was, you know, going to help you all out. And I want to tell you, for those of you who haven't yet maybe gotten into the service in this, to giving away this program, here's what happened to me the next week. I'm at the door, and gee, a newcomer arrived. And she said her name to me, and I said, my name's Pat, and she said, I'm scared. And I said, so am I. And I tell you, that's the first time I know I ever acknowledged that I was scared. I don't think I ever, and what did it take? It took me being of service, hearing it from a newcomer, to recognize myself. It kind of scared me, to tell you the truth, but that was my beginning in Al-Anon, and my real beginning started when I had that little experience at the door. The newcomer didn't come back, didn't matter, because I had what I needed from her. I don't know that I fully appreciated the value of that for a while. I knew something about me, because I was not one to go around saying, gee, I'm scared. I would not do that. I look cool, you know, I look good. And I had reason to look good. I had this man I was married to who required a lot of managing. And I would like to tell you that when I met him, I wasn't one of these Al-Anon members, I hear this said in meetings a lot, who married somebody and they go along for a while and then their spouse begins drinking a little too much and then it develops into alcoholism. And much to their surprise, this man's an alcoholic or this woman's an alcoholic. I met Cliff and he was drunk as a skunk. It was at a party at San Jose State. We were seniors, I guess, or maybe juniors anyway, whatever. And he was really angry about something, which was to be the story of my life later on. But I had never seen, I hadn't been around much anger as I grew up. And I just had never seen anything like it. And I was fascinated. He had these real glasses, because we didn't have anything else back then, and he was breaking them against the refrigerator on the back porch and cussing. And he was using these four-letter words. Well, this was right after the war. It was 1946. I'm 70-ish. I'm running out of issues, but he's closer to being out of issues than I am. And it was right after the war, and all these guys had come out of the war. They're on the GI Bill, and I'm a little 18-year-old kid coming right out of high school, and I just moved away from home, not all 12 miles, you know, but it was a big deal to me, and I was really living it up, and I had the best time in college. Way too much fun. I forgot about studying and things like that, and I heard these four-letter words, just streams of them coming out of him, And I knew kind of what, I didn't hear those kind of words where I grew up in this small town. And I heard these little, you know, and I thought, wow. And I turned to my date, who was, happened to be his roommate, and I said, who is that and what's he doing? And he said, that's Cliff Roach. He always does that when he gets drunk. So I hardly entered into a friendship with this man, not knowing, for God's sakes. And I was kind of fascinated by the four-letter words I was hearing. There was some kind of glamorous and exciting about that. I didn't know what a lot of them meant. I knew kind of what they meant, but I didn't know which word meant which action. And I didn't want to use the wrong word in the wrong place, you know. And so I didn't use them, but it really, really fascinated me. And it was a couple of weeks later, and I was walking across campus, and we ran into each other. And I don't know if he remembers me, because he was probably in a, I mean, very well could have been an alcoholic blackout that night. But we started chatting, and you could see he's a very funny person. And he was, in college, he was a drama major, particularly in comedy. And he just does it without even, he can't be any differently, I don't think. Well, he can at home a little bit, but... I probably give him plenty of cause. And this bee began buzzing about him. You know how a bee will just get there and won't go away? So he dropped his books and he began having a fist fight with the bee. You know, you've seen him. You know, you can imagine. It was so funny. And a bunch of us just sat down and were laughing. And he, of course, the more we laughed, the more he did it. And traffic was stopping along San Carlos Street there because they couldn't see the bee. You know, they just see this guy out there by himself doing all the moves. And I remember thinking, gee, this guy's funny. He really is funny. So we began seeing each other. And I did not fall in love with him the night I met him, for God's sakes. I wasn't that sick. And... But I remember clearly the moment when I thought, I'm going to hang on to this guy. And here's why. We were all in a car, a bunch of us, as you do when you're in college, going somewhere. And we were singing. And we were singing the desert song, which very few of you will know. Goes back before our time, really, but it's an operetta song. And he began singing in the voice of Donald Duck. It's one of the funniest things I ever heard in my life. Now, wouldn't you want to marry somebody that could sing like Donald Duck? I laugh in this program. We seem to make a lot of references to ducks. I know my mom had she was an alcoholic lady, and she was living with us and still drinking when we came in here. And we were told you can't diagnose somebody alcoholic, you just, you know, but if she walks like a duck and she talks like a duck, you know how we hear that. And then I heard an Alan on describing some of us as looking like ducks in a pond, and we're just gliding across the top of the water, but underneath our feet are just paddling like hell. But my favorite is from Peggy Martin in Omaha, and she said she met an Al-Anon man who said he'd been in Al-Anon a little while and he felt like he got his ducks all lined up, and he was told by the Al-Anon members that they were not his ducks. And I tell you, I think I've spent my entire life in Al-Anon trying to figure out what are my ducks and what aren't. And I mean, I'm not alone in that. I hear a lot of Al-Anon members constantly figuring, do I belong in this or don't I? What's my role here? Who am I supposed to be? Especially when you have kids. And I just felt like, boy, does that name me right down the line? So I'm still trying to identify my ducks, and I get it wrong sometimes. But most of the time, there are very few ducks that are mine. Mostly they look like me. But I was raised with a lot of love and a lot of laughter. My mother was one of the funniest people I've ever met. And in a very witty way, a little bitty gal, 4'10". And no surprise to hear, she was adventurous and full of hell, and she was a beautiful alcoholic woman who had a wonderful time. And in spite of her alcoholism, which I will call it because anybody who knew her in the later years would call it that, anybody who knew her loved her. And even when she was drinking, she was a binge drinker in my early years, which probably accounts for why I don't have the dark awful experiences that many people in this room do, raised with alcoholism, because we had long periods of time where she didn't drink, and she was comfortable when she didn't drink. And when she did drink, we had to keep her secret, small town. That's one of the things, one of the little rules of life I learned. And that, by the way, didn't work at all with him. Mother was a little woman. When she drank, she just got kind of quiet and sat in a chair and rocked back and forth and said kind of dumb things. And that's about the worst of it, except she did get into the habit of making these midnight phone calls that alcoholics always seem to make. What is it about that? And we still get them from one of his nephews in lives in Oklahoma and doesn't care what time it is, and he still calls. And I always seem to be the one answering the phone when he does, you know. But I just think I had a real blessing there, because we had a great time. If in our little town, when you picked up the telephone, you picked it up, the receiver off the wall, and you told the operator who you wanted to talk to. And they had little phone numbers, but nobody bothered with them because we all knew each other's. And she would do that at midnight or so, and she would say, "Let me talk to Hazel," you know. And the operator would say, "Pauline, go back to bed. Hazel's in bed." You know. So we weren't really keeping it a secret, you know. Plus, the operator was our cousin. Everybody was our cousin in that time. And so, you know, but we did learn to try to keep it a secret and to try to, when, and I learned to know when she was probably going to be drinking again. And as alcoholism does, it progressed. And the years went by, and it got more often that she drank and more troublesome when she did drink. And certainly the periods in between were lesser and lesser. And I, by this time, was well into high school and almost out of high school. So I had a real good beginning. And I had a wonderful grandmother who believed, she was a very poor woman who had left Minnesota, Blooming Prairie, Minnesota, and with two little girls, divorced a husband. She's a Methodist, that's very unusual. And got herself to California and raised those girls on her own at a time in the early 1900s when that was simply not the usual thing. And she was a person who automatically, a lot of the things I've learned in here I knew. And I've probably lost track of them over the years, but I had learned them. Certainly the great concept of if you give something away, you'll get it back in some way. That was just her way of life. There's no question about it. She had great faith and a comfortable faith. And she really gave me some part of my foundation that I've constantly think of, constantly. And my father was a member of the Masonic Lodge. Very devoted member and a 32nd degree Shriner. And he practiced the spiritual teachings of the Masonic Lodge, if you know about them. And that's very, a lot of us very much like what we do in here. It's very broad. Now, I married this guy that was Catholic. And back in those days, those two didn't always mix too well. And he was a little skeptical, but when Mom found out he was Irish, and then when she found out he liked to drink, she loved him. And that went on to the end. And I'm very grateful for that today. Sometimes they were a little hard to have them together in the same room, and a few times during our moves around, we stayed with them for short periods of time, and they'd go grocery shopping, and they'd bring home the damnedest things. You know, pickled pig's feet, you know, and vodka. That's what we'd get, you know. So when I tell you, you know, I know that I wasn't raised with the amount of fear, and I was raised with self-esteem, and that Mom was the first one who used to say to me, nobody really makes a mistake, we just learn. And, you know, a lot of people don't get that, and I know that. In this program, we do that all the time. In fact, one of the things I love about this program, I was just saying something to Beth about it, says this is one of the places where if you screw it up here at the microphone, everybody applauds. Do you say screw it up here in where I am? Uh-oh. That's the way it was told to me. So, you know, when I entered into this marriage, we had a lot of the same goals. I mean, we didn't really talk about them a lot. We just kind of stumbled on in and got married. And he wasn't practicing his religion then, which was kind of a relief. And he was practicing his alcoholism, I'll tell you that. And so we began working in a way that towards his career as an actor, because he certainly has the talent to do that. And meanwhile, the anger was surfacing more and more. And I was completely baffled about that. And I started believing, and I believed for many years, that I had to be the one to make life okay for him so he wouldn't have to be angry. And you know, I did, for over the 20 years until we got here, I tried everything anybody could think of to make his life work for him so he wouldn't have to be angry. And so many times over those years, my whole goal would become keep Daddy okay. And when you do that, you don't do a lot of other things that need to be done, like paying attention to the kids' needs, and on and on. And keeping Daddy okay meant a lot of things. A few years, we've been in here a few years when Cliff was given a talk. Sometimes, I don't think he talked about it Monday night, but he talks about knowing that when he began trying to, he was in the program and was believing that he was not loved enough. And his sponsor taught him to know he didn't love enough. He expresses it beautifully when he talks about it. And he said he learned here that there isn't enough. There isn't enough. And when I came into Al-Anon, you began teaching me, you can't do it. You haven't got what it takes to do this. You cannot get him sober. Of course, I got kind of clear after a while. You cannot be the person to make him okay and not angry. There isn't enough that you can give him. There isn't enough attention, there isn't enough love that you can give him, because that comes from inside him. He really talks about it quite often, and you know, that's one of the things you taught me. Not easy to let go of, though. So meanwhile, we start off on this path, and this anger was increasing, and he decided to go back to the Catholic Church. Well, I was a little skeptical, kind of all this incense and stuff in the air, I don't know what that was all about, but he went. And you know, it seemed to me he calmed down a little bit. And I kind of watched that, and I thought, wow. And I learned here, and I think I might have realized before, that he was searching for spiritual help all along, you know, but he just couldn't find it. And so I got to thinking about, well, this is probably a good thing, going to this thing. So I joined it to keep him there. And I didn't have the best reason to join a church, but you know, it's interesting to me, because when I was attending that church, and we did that for some years, there was a one place a week that I would sit still, because I'm not a person to sit still, and just let go and remember what I've been taught as a child, that I could trust in a God, that I can trust in power and help from that. And I'd lost that somewhere along the line. And that was the only time a week when I did that. That was very good for me, very good for me. So getting him in the Catholic Church was a good idea, except it did help his anger for a period of time, but it sure didn't do anything to the drinking, because I found out the priests all drink. Boy, do they drink. And of course, he made friends with the ones who do, and we had our house full of priests drinking, you know. And it just increased the numbers in my house is what it did. And of course, it also gave us the 5 kids, because I follow the rules. If I join a church, I follow the rules. And God in his wisdom knew that those 5 kids, if nothing else, would keep me coming to Al-Anon, I'll tell you. Those of you with kids, you know. But that was a good piece of things. And we had parties in our house all the time. And I love the parties. I grew up with parties. Fun stuff. Laughter. Good stuff. We always kept running out of money, because the acting thing fell through. Largely after 6 years of that, we tried. He finally figured out that sitting in the offices of these casting directors, they just didn't realize how sensitive he was. And there's nobody in the world that understands that except a bunch of alcoholics. I just love it. And I thought too, oh, they don't, you know. He is sensitive. Don't they know how upset he gets when things go wrong? And of course, we all know today what that was. But and so he began working, or teaching. Now, I had worked his way through teacher training. There we go again. Because I had this some kind of sense back there to figure out that's probably not a bad idea to have a little something to fall back on. And I was always working and doing what I did. But we was always running out of money, and so I would never generate enough money, and these 5 kids were keeping me busy. And I was used to being involved in civic affairs. That was part of the way I was raised, you participate. And so I did all those things still, and I Gosh, I helped all my neighbors once they found out I had been a psychology major. And all feeding my ego, everything I did. And so then we needed more money. So I thought, well, I was the one that had to generate it. There was no question about that. So more, and I was already doing stuff. But so I began giving piano lessons in my home. Now, I didn't know how to give piano lessons. I know how to play the piano. I love kids. And I guess that worked, because when I came in this program, I was giving 37 piano lessons a week. That's a lot. And the reason I remember that number is because he never got out the front door to work without my saying, I'm giving 37 pianos. You really embed it, you know. And he didn't appreciate that. And I began this path that so many of us do of developed my whole life. My whole goal was to keep Daddy okay. And I didn't so much continue to try to stop the drinking or cut back on it. I kind of wanted him to drink some. I don't want to give up all those parties. In fact, he did too sometimes. I think back, he said to me one time, you know, we were going someplace, and he said, I really don't want to get drunk. So will you keep an eye on me? Well, yeah, I could do that. And I knew how to do that. And he says, you can tell, can't you? And he said, you just come and whisper in my ear. And you just say, and he gave me my lines. And he said, you just say, honey, it's time to stop now. And I would do that. And you know what he'd do? He'd use one of those four-letter words. And I'd be so hurt, because he had asked me to do that, you know. And then the next day he'd claim he didn't remember. So, you know, I kind of knew all along that in spite of how angry he was and how hard that was to live with, I kind of knew somewhere in my heart that he didn't want to be that way. And I certainly knew that was true of my mother, because when she got drunk, I knew she wasn't the kind of person that wanted to be that way. And I knew it had to be some other power. I didn't have any information really about alcoholism, but I just, in my heart, I knew there's something else here. I just didn't know what it was. And I was getting mad myself, and of course scared. And when you're scared, you act mad. You know, so who gets mad? I'm not going to get mad at him, because he'll get madder than I do. So I get mad at whoever's close by. And you know who that is. It's the kids and the dog and any neighbor that's a little vulnerable and can't stand up for herself and whatever, you know, really sick behavior. Whatever it took for me to look good by looking better than somebody else constantly. You know, frankly, I think it's real good, easy to look good when you're married to an alcoholic, because you don't have to do anything, especially one like him. You just stand there and he'll do something bad enough that, you know, you gotta look good no matter what you do. But there were those good times. And I developed this very, hopefully, piano studio in my living room. And my goal was to have this dignified piano studio and help this family out. And of course you have to do that after school, largely. Well, after school at our house meant, well, the way it's set up, the living room is here, and then in the next section was a dining room and a kitchen, and the back section is big family room and bedroom things. And there were two ins and outs for the living room. And the thing is, I'd be teaching, and one, you know, he'd do something so damn funny. One time I was teaching a little kid to play Humoresque. Anybody who studied music knows there's a little dancing number. And the kid's back is to the room, because I'm facing the room. And out of one door comes this man with a rose in his mouth and a little pair of white shorts with red devils on them that I'm dancing across the room. Now, how do you stay mad at somebody? I think being with an alcoholic is like playing the slot machines, you know, they pay off just often enough. And that concept came to me in Reno, Nevada, at an AALNON conference, and I was sitting there playing the slot machine with quarters on a cheapskate, and the guy next to me got up and left, and he had been getting some money out of his, and mine wasn't doing anything. I thought, maybe I ought to shift over to that machine. I thought, no, I got too much invested in this one. I thought, oh, geez. That sounds like a familiar thought. And I did all these things. One time I got him to go to a psychiatrist, which you can't always get somebody to do, you know, but he did. And the psychiatrist prescribed Antabuse. I knew nothing about that little pill. And he was willing to take it because it was getting pretty scary. His drinking was increasing, of course, as it does. And I decided I better, but we both knew that he probably couldn't go weekends without drinking if we could just get him through the school week. So I, in my little cleverness, went down to the nearby medical library at UCSD and looked up, and I'd studied some chemistry in my science minor, and I thought I knew something. And I looked up the formula for antabuse, and whatever I was doing, I have no idea. I was so crazy then. But I figured if he took one on Monday and one on Tuesday and a half of one on Wednesday, he could safely drink on Friday. And so each morning as he left for school, I would pop the antabuse in his mouth. Of course, he had a little help there. And one time I did that, and he came home and was drinking, and he wasn't getting sick, and I realized he hadn't swallowed the darn thing. So after that, you know, have you ever given a pill to a dog where you just stroke the thing? And you know, if his Adam's apple went up and down, I knew I was going to have a good day. But the doctor died. I was a little irritated at that. And so we didn't have a prescription anymore. And I don't really know if my plan worked, because he never made it to Friday. He drank on Thursday night. And if you've seen anybody drink on antabuse, it ain't a pretty sight. Big red blotches, and of course his blood pressure grew up, and he'd be... I loved it when he got real anxious and scared, you know, that was kind of fun. But, but you know, he really was scary, and he'd bring on these big red glowing spots all over. And in fact, it became... Arnie, we raised the kids in a cul-de-sac there with about 7 or 8 other families, and they were... everybody mixed together a lot. And the kids began coming over on Thursday nights to watch Mr. Roach glow. Thursday night phenomenon in our neighborhood. So we had no antabuse prescription. So being the resourceful person I had become, we lived just 35 miles or 40, I guess, from the Mexican border. And of course, you can get anything there. It's illegal, and I didn't go around breaking laws. But I would put my small child, I always had a small child, and I would drive our station wagon, and I would wear, this is in the 60s, late 60s, I would wear my two-piece polyester pantsuit with my bubble hairdo, and I would go down to Tijuana, and I'd put her in a stroller, and I'd go from pharmacy to pharmacy buying antabuse. Now, I didn't want them to know how much I was buying, see. If you've ever been to any of those kind of places, they'd be delighted to sell me their whole stock, but I would be embarrassed if they thought I needed that much antabuse. So I'd get this supply of antabuse. Now there I am with contraband. And I thought, I got to cross the border and I've got this child. So I bought a pinata. And is there anything more innocent looking than a little old suburban station wagon and a bubble hairdo and a small child and a pinata in the back seat? But I'd sit at that border. Sometimes you had to wait a couple hours. But my mind would start going. I said, oh God. You know, I'm smuggling drugs, and if they catch me, they're going to put me in a federal prison. I think that's what they do, and they'll take my small child into a shelter, and then I think, then he'll know the sacrifices I've gone to. It's all worth it. Years after we'd come in the program and he wasn't drinking for years, we found a broken pinata in the garage with antabuse all over the place. Some kid had come in there, the pinata was there, I just never got to it, I guess, and, you know, decided to do what you do with pinatas, and we're a little disappointed, you know, they didn't get the candy, they thought. But I just thought that was hilarious. Surprised me, but not the kid. I mean, it was just funny. But, you know, those are the things I did over and over, and I gave up things, made sacrifices. And it was embarrassing sometimes to be trying to run a dignified piano studio because all these people would come home from school. My mother had come to live with us. My father had died of a heart attack. And he had apparently, from what people learned, he had lay on the kitchen, on the bathroom floor for about 5 hours before my mom, who was drunk, was able to recognize that he needed help. We don't know if he would have lived if he had help earlier. He didn't. And, you know, I knew my mom would never do that if she knew what she was doing. And what a terrible, terrible thing for her to walk around knowing. But of course, by this time, her drinking was relieving her of all kinds of things like that, so she never expressed it. But my gosh, you know, just the pain she must have been in. But he invited Mom to come live with us. Well, that's fine. They loved each other. Well, how do I fix that? You're having a hard time hearing me over there? So do I talk more slowly? Sometimes that's a problem I have. That might help. I'll talk more slowly. Oh dear, if I do that, I'll have to go overtime. No, I bring my own speech coach with me. He usually slows me down. He wasn't doing that, so I guess he figures I'm doing okay. But anyway, Mom came to live with us, and boy, did she like it there, I'll tell you. Because, for one thing, they got along very well, as you might guess, and she loved our parties, and she loved our friends, and all the kids loved her. Everybody loved Pauline. She was on a walker because she'd fallen and broken her hip. She didn't remember how that happened, and she thought it was kind of odd. It had never really hurt. But she had also been prescribed some pain pills, of course. So now she was periodic alcoholic and a daily pill head. Meanwhile, Cliff's cousin, who was a physician, had helped him out with some pills, help him relax. In fact, they were the original ones were called Relaxamin. And so he was, of course, a daily drunk and a periodic pill head. And my kids, of course, were finding little ways to relieve their tension. And I didn't know much about those street drugs. I really didn't. And all the neighborhood kids were always at our house, coming in and out that back door, because a big family room is back there. And I'm teaching piano. I'm the one making the sacrifices. And all in the middle of the house are all these teachers making margaritas on three blenders. And I was counting the margaritas. And that's, you know, you get pretty good at stuff. I could teach, I could tell you when that kid made a mistake, I could tell you what batch of margaritas were on, and before long I'd tell you what sale my son was making out the back door of the house. And the bedrooms were lined up in a row. It was an older home where you push the windows up, and I could tell, a couple of my daughter's boyfriends had taken to climbing in the bedroom windows for some reason, and they didn't have to. They were glad, we were happy to have them walk in the front or back door, but I think they'd gotten in the habit along the way. And I could tell you which window had just opened. And I mean, I think it's amazing the skills we develop on our own. But I'm trying to keep a dignified household. And there were times, I'm amazed when I look back at how I came up, you know, looking good, I think. One time I looked out my window, it was about 5 in the morning because he wasn't home. And there he is, and it was summer, and it was daylight, and he spread-eagled on the front lawn, stark naked. And we lived on a corner where everybody drove by, and he was surrounded by a little ring of paper boys. So I'm looking out at that thinking, oh my God. And I thought fast. And I went out and said, Mr. Roach is practicing a new form of meditation. I'm so proud of that. I mean, when I remembered that incident, and something reminded me of it one time we'd been in the program, because he didn't remember. He said, oh my God, which end was up? And of course, and I didn't know, and that hurt his feelings. That wasn't what I was interested in at the moment. And he'd gone to Mexico, because he was a surfer. He'd gone out to Mexico and he purchased a Mexican, what he called his Mexican art object, which is a large wooden carving with a man's hand and a particular finger extended. Big, big. And he brought that home and he put it on my piano. And he said, this is my house and this is my philosophy of life. Clunk. Now, by this time, I had lost track of my choices. And I mean, any Alma in the room knows that what this is. I really lost track of all these other ways I could handle something. All I could think of was not making him angry. So if I took it off and said I won't put it there, there would have been a scene. So I would leave it there and then sneak it down the floor behind me before the piano lesson started, and then put it back before he knew. But you can't be perfect. And The day came, you know, it was bound to happen. And I'm giving this little kid a piano lesson. His mother said, "Can I come in?" And, "Sure, come on." And she was not watching her child. Her eyes were going right to the... I thought, oh, no. And she was the wife of the Baptist minister, which I think was kind of an extra special touch. And so, you know, it was hard to stay dignified. That's what I'm getting to here. But the parties were fun. My mom was fun. My mom was happier than she'd ever been in her life, because nobody bugged her about her drinking. I had long since quit trying to do that. He brought home the booze, and everybody loved her. Just everybody loved her. We've been in the program a bit. I'm going to tell you this now because I forget if I do, don't. And mom was still periodic, and there was no alcohol in our house, except, well, I don't know what the kids had in the back room, but, you know, there was nothing. And she did what an alcoholic, periodic alcoholic does. She said to me, "Pat, we've been working hard. Why don't we have a bottle of wine and relax?" Now, I had developed a couple of ways to deal with my mom's drinking over the years. And one was to scold her and tell her that she tended to get too much to drink and blah, blah, blah. And the other was to pretend like, "Oh, sure, okay, let's do that," like there was no big deal. But you see, I'd been coming to Al-Anon a little while by then. Never know what I'm going to learn. Don't know what I'm going to learn that I think I don't need at the time. And I said something quite different to her, and it wasn't me speaking. And this has happened to me a lot. I said, "Mom, the last time you went on a binge, you had a stroke, and the doctor didn't think you could live through another one, and I cannot drink with you. I love you, and you're sure welcome to come to Alcoholics Anonymous with you. You're free to..." She could get her own booze, by the way. She didn't need us to do that. She had her own way of doing that. And I want to tell you, my mom, she didn't drink. She didn't go to AA. And 2 days later, my mom took her own life. Because in that very short time, I really loved my mom. I had been coming here, and also to AA, and I knew you wonderful people. People poured in my house, especially the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially Bill's wife, Margie. And she said, "Pat, there's nothing you could have done." She knew my mom, of course. She said she couldn't bear the thought of trying to get sober. If she drank anyway, she would be making quite a statement about her problem, about her need to drink. And she said she knew her, and she said she couldn't tolerate any of those choices. And I was never felt that I had anything to do with that, except that I had released her with love. Didn't even know I was going to do it. And that's one of the first gifts, big important gifts I got in this program. She would have been a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was 64 years old. God, I'm 76 now, you know, and she, you know, she was young to go. And I also knew her philosophy about suicide. She thought it was perfectly okay. So, you know, I understood it in some ways. But that's how great a good time she was having. So today I can look back at that and be so grateful that she and my husband got along so beautifully, that she had those wonderful, wonderful years with us, full of laughter, full of silliness, full of kids who loved her, full of all kinds of people who loved her. And isn't that a nice thing to be able to know we could give her, even if it was pretty sick at the time, but it was for her. And that's a nice memory for me. Meanwhile, I'm, of course, doing what I'm supposed to do, and Cliff has gone again around the corner one more time back into this program and knocked on Bill Blake's door, and now he's running to these stupid meetings, and he was, as he had done before, he was a mess when he got sober, and I hear that from all kinds of people. It's just a tough way to go. Margie was one of my biggest helps in the beginning. I'd go running over to her house and I'd carry on and carry on and yell and scream, and she'd say, "Pat, you have to trust." And I'd say, "I can't trust him. I can't trust him." She'd say, "Not him, I mean God." She'd say, "I don't trust him either." Wonderful help. And she's the lady, I did go to meetings in Oceanside and developed a good close group of friends there. But people weren't sponsoring people much, and there weren't any formal step study meetings. It was Al-Anon, and they were doing what they could. And she knew of a place up the road, not that far, in Laguna Beach, that had been started by Elsa Chamberlain. And she took her time to take this yappity-yappity little Al-Anon up to that meeting several times in a row until I got to know people. And that's really, I had the best of all worlds. I had my group at home, and I had these wonderful, experienced people in Laguna Beach. And I heard things there that the people in my little area just weren't saying. It doesn't mean they weren't good Al-Anons. I remember I'd only been going a few weeks when Elsa said, you know, sometimes sober is worse than drunk. And I was so stunned, you know, because she's married to this god. And everybody says, yeah, you know. And I'm saying, yeah, you know, because that was my problem. You know, this is not so good, you know. And she would say things like that. She gave us wonderful messages. She had, though some of you know, here knew her. And she never, she always treated all of us the same. And as if we were her best friend, and as if we were as dear to her as anybody. And she was a wonderful influence. She was one when we were having a step meeting, a six or seven step meeting. And I was talking about how so many of the character defects I had uncovered in my inventory seemed to be my strengths. I mean, they seemed to be, I'm organized, you know, this is good. But, you know, it isn't good if you're controlling the world and they don't want to be controlled, but it's not a bad trait. And I said, and she said, here's what I did. She said, you take a character trait and you identify it, and then you look at how you've used it well or used it badly. And I could do that. That was a wonderful thing to say. When I was, some years later, when I was elected delegate, and I wasn't being treated very, very nicely by some people, they didn't recognize my importance. And we know better, but, you know, at the moment, it was a moment. And I said, God, you know, this service work doesn't, you know, it's really getting me down. And she says, are you interested? You strike me as a person that are interested in giving to the world. And that was true, basically true of me. And I said, well, I am. And she said, well, you know, there's no end to the amount of good you can do if you don't care who gets the credit. I didn't really like that when I heard it, but but how true. And what a gift it is at those moments when we can, or I can do something and not get the credit. And what a feeling one gets that we don't get any other way. And I like that. I don't get to do it. I mean, I don't, you know, do it real well all the time. But what a gift that is. And so here we go on this road to happy destiny. And the kids, meanwhile, they're growing up, you know. And they're starting to smell musty. I don't know what, you know what that was? I thought they weren't washing their hair or something, I don't know. But I did know when they smelled musty. My kids, I had my kids, and we always had kids that were living with us. I guess our house was better than theirs, which is a stretch, you know, but we always had kids really living with us. I mean, living there, day and night, going to school. And then we had all kinds of kids there all the time, just because we didn't have a lot of kids, and you're sociable, you do that. And would smell musty, some of them, the ones that didn't do that, well, like to remind me of that, they sure were easy to get along with. And I kind of liked that, you know. I thought, this is not so bad. Don't know what it is, but it's not so bad. And then I began finding those little white pills with crosses on them. And I know that when those were in the house, they were busy. And they would do anything. I mean, they would scrub my car in the middle of the night. And it was a beehive of activity. And that's kind of nice to have happen every now and then, you know. They'd always, nobody would go to school the next day. They'd all be crashed, you know, I learned later. But, and so there I am with all these. And the kids, and then they're taking other funny little things. And at the time, I have to tell you, because Cliff was talking about his reaction to some of this. I never told him what I knew about those kids, because this time I was not going to let him know the problems that were going on, and when he was drinking, and even for a while in sobriety, because I didn't want to deal with that as well. So this poor guy, later, of course, he learned all this. This poor guy is watching this behavior just thinking they're all screwy as anything. You know, he just thought they were nuts. He didn't know what I knew, which helps a little to know that, you know. And so I would run to my friend on the police force, a detective I knew, and I said, what's this? What's this? I'd show him something. And he'd say, well, that's a Quaalude, and here's what happens when they take that. And he'd say, well, that's LSD, and here's what happens when they take that. And he'd give me antidotes. I know, I look back, I think I was narking on my own kids, you know. He never did any more than that, you know. I just didn't put it there. I just wanted to know. I needed to know. And I was, you know, I had to find answers. There's a page in our One Day at a Time book. It's July 20th. And Winnie, a friend of mine in Southern California that also I was able to grow up with, named Winnie Eddy, when I would be talking with her, I said, I just don't understand. If I could just understand, I could figure out what to do. And she pointed out this page. It says, just go back and read July 20th. And it's about our incessant need to understand. To understand. And it straightens us out if you read it. And I just felt if I could just understand it, I guess I'd have an answer. And of course, you can't constantly in here were telling me those weren't my ducks. Didn't have to understand that. I just do my thing. And so little by little, I began learning about myself. And my first sponsor was Sally C., who some of you may know. And then they began moving around so much that my sponsor today is Karen A., a Swedish lady from Laguna Beach. And I see her almost every week. And I stay in close contact with a sponsor. I need to do that. It was Sally that mentioned to me early on. She said, you need to start apologizing to Cliff. You guys are really arguing. I don't know how she knew that. And so I said, he's awful. I'm not going to apologize to him, and then he'll think what he's doing is okay. And she said, that's not your business. She'd say, you just take care of your side of the street. So I let him off the hook. It really made me mad. She said, just do it. Well, I liked Sally, and I wanted to impress Sally. So sure enough, we had another big blow up. And this is how my program was working in my life, folks. And I walked out of the room. I thought, this would be one of those times, I think, where I should probably apologize. So I went back in, and these are the words I said, as far as I can remember. I said, Cliff, I want to apologize to you for the way I reacted to your childish and immature outburst. It's my recovery. And I called Sally. And of course, it was fresh in my mind. And she first said, what did Cliff say? And I said, he said, thank you, kind of. And she said, well, honey, it's a start. And that's where my head was. He did not deserve to be left off, but get let off the hook. I used to say, excuse me, this ice tastes good. I used to think, this is my turn now. For 20 years, he's had his turn. It's my turn. And I'd say that, it's my turn. Now, I had the foggiest idea what I was going to do with my turn. But I knew I had one coming. I must have one coming. So I just knew this. I had this anger in me, and the fear still, because the anger was still in him. And one time I was sitting in an Alamo meeting, an old Millie. There was something I was wanting to do, and I was saying I was trying to decide whether I should do this or not. And she said, well, why don't you just do it? And I said, oh, he'll be mad. And she said it in such a way. Yeah, that's what mattered. It was the way she said it. She says, well, honey, just let him be mad. Well, I'd never thought of that. Easier said than done, by the way. But it was the way she said it. Like, well, that's a simple answer. Simple, not easy. And little by little, I began learning how to back away from being the person to fix his anger, because he now had Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you, I came to love Bill Blake. And we became very fast friends. This is a man who I was very embarrassed to have in my life. For one thing, he had been a drunk wino on the streets of Oceanside. And when he was drinking, he'd had his picture taken. No, he didn't have it taken. That's the wrong way to say it. The Planning Commission had taken his picture as a way and put it on the front page of the newspaper in order to convince people of the need for downtown redevelopment. And he was so drunk, leaning against this. It was his back. And you can tell by his posture that he was relieving himself on the parking meter. And it was in the paper. I hadn't seen it those years ago, but he had taken that thing and framed it, and he had it on the wall of his office. The Oceanside, I think it's probably still there, because his stepson is running it now. It's the Oceanside Electric Company. And he was so proud of that. Now, that was a hard thing for me to accept. That was not the way I was raised. I mean, I was raised poor, but with dignity. And there's a line, one of the readings we commonly read in California is from a little pamphlet we have that's called Understanding Ourselves and Understanding Alcoholism. And we read the Understanding Ourselves at just most of our meetings. We certainly do at our Maguna meeting. And in there, there's a little short saying that some of us, when we come in, are arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and dominating. Now, for you members of AA who have a spouse in Alma, or anybody, I have just given you a dreadful weapon. Be careful how you use it. But it's in print in a little pamphlet. And it's a great line, because that's exactly who I was. Arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and dominated. And under it all was what? Fear. Just fear. And little by little, I began. I was taught the way to get over your fear is you do something while you're scared. Because I thought I'd come in a meeting, and I'd get this nice feeling from everybody, and that would be spiritual. And then my emotions would settle down, and then I would do things that I normally would be afraid of. And most of the time, that does happen now and then, most of the time it's been absolutely the opposite. I did something while scared. Anyway, trusting that what my sponsor and the other Alma members were telling me would work, because it worked for them. And I'd do it while scared, and then I'd think, oh, I was feeling pretty good about myself, you know? And then I would recognize in some way that I had just touched with God. I'd just gotten in touch with God. And it came about backwards many, many times. Cliff and our oldest son used to argue terribly. And I was always in the middle saying, now, David, Daddy didn't really mean that. Now, Cliff, if you say it differently, he would understand. I mean, right there, helping him out for years. That was my pattern. I was told to stop that. I said, I can't stop it. God knows what will happen if I'm not there. And my sponsor said, leave the house. What? Leave my post, you know? But you see, I'd learned to believe in you people. I'd learned to believe in what that you told me what worked for you. And I was willing to do that. The first time I did that, they were arguing. And I walked out my back door, and I walked for a couple of hours, crying the whole time. And when I came back, whatever had gone on was gone, was done. I do not know what they said. I don't need to know. And I experienced again the relief one gets from recognizing that this isn't as bad as I thought. This isn't as scary as I thought. I would say I spent a whole lot of my years in Al-Anon walking through fear. Now, old Millie was a bossy old gal, and she hauled me into service. She said I had potential. Well, that's, of course I did. And she hauled me down to San Diego, and at that time, because we were 30 miles up the road, oh, you may have picked up from my husband last night, yeah. And they were starting what's called there a San Diego intergroup, most places call it an information service. And she needed a ride. She claimed she didn't drive. I never really believed her, but because I think she just got us to go places that way. And so I drove her to this meeting where they were putting together the bylaws for the new intergroup in San Diego, and I had no role to play there except I was the driver. And I wasn't in very long, so I sat back. And those people, and that, you know, do you ever notice when we get into service how we change personalities? You know, we're so kind and sweet in meetings. When we get in service, we have a cause. And we're right. You know, I do it myself. And they began arguing with each other. It really was awful. And I sat there and I'd never heard that. And I remember feeling scared. I thought, oh my God, this is awful. And then one of the women said, we aren't putting principles above personalities. Let's say the Serenity Prayer and start this discussion again. And I sat there watching that wonderful tradition at work. Now, I felt a change in myself. I can only tell you that. I can only know that something entered in me that was truly spiritual, and that I had truly been given a gift. I couldn't have described it very well, but I knew something, because I had read that tradition. We've all read it by that time, and I'd certainly heard it read, but I watched it happen. And I was very quiet on the way home, which was not like me. And when I got home, our 14-year-old daughter, who was angry all the time, wanted to go play with the 21-year-olds, which is usually what she wanted. She was starting her story into AA back then. And she kept saying, I kept saying no to her, and I'd gotten in the habit with her of doing, letting her get away with more than I needed, than I should have, because her dad was real hard on her because, well, there were a couple of blossom alcoholics, you know, they got mad, they were just alike is what it was. And so I was going to make it better for her. And what I gave her was not even one responsible parent. She had one that was irritated and knew sobriety and angry, and she had this other one over here who was giving in to her all the time. And so this time I came back, and right that day, and again, God in his wisdom didn't give me too much time to have to think. And she kept saying she wanted to go, and I kept saying no. And she said, "I hate you." She screamed it. She says, "I hate you." And I'd never had a child say that to me. And I answered her this way. I said, "Jen, it's more important for me to like myself than it is for you to like me." They weren't my words, folks. One more time, out of my mouth, came these words. And I knew at that moment that I was going to get to be a good mother again. I knew how to be a good mother. The biggest pains I had with my own fourth step and talking about it with my sponsor was my lowering my own standards over and over and over again under the umbrella of peace at any price. And that's what I did. And I had to kind of walk back through all those little changes I'd made little by little. First of all, I had to find out what they were, what my values were, because I'd lost track. And that was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. I have never failed to have, continue to have, this kind of growth doing Al-Anon service. But if you're interested in it, you got to sit through the other stuff too. Which I got coming, I'm telling you, I got it coming. I spent a lot of years bossing a lot of people around who didn't want to be bossed. And it's very good for me to sit there and keep my mouth shut. I didn't say it was easy, I said it was good for me. So I've gotten a lot from that, a whole lot from that, and I'm very grateful. And it all started with old Millie. Millie gave me a letter M for my chest. She said, "You're a member of the Varsity Martyr Squad." It hurt my feelings. But you know, back in those days, I had a reason to return to a town we lived in called Manteca, up in the Grand Central Valley, where he taught school there for 3 years. Very hard to keep him a secret there. Terrible little town in my memory. And I went back there to speak one time, years and years later, and it was in the fall and the trees were all, we don't get a lot of colors in our trees out there in change of seasons, but they do in Manteca. And the colors were all on the trees, and it was beautiful. My daughter was with me. And I said, "Kitty, I don't remember the trees doing this when we were here." She said, "Well, sure they did, Mom. I couldn't see colors when I lived there." And I didn't even realize that till I went back. And another thing came to me. When I used to give piano lessons, the kids would ask what those tiny little notes are that come before a regular note. Anybody who studied music know what a grace note is. It's just a little tiny note, and it doesn't get part of the count. You just slip it in, it dresses it up, it gives it a nice little extra sound. And I remembered saying to a kid, "Oh, just ignore that." I wasn't hearing grace notes anymore. I hear a lot of them today, I'll tell you, a real lot of them, all the time, because now I can hear the grace notes. I couldn't hear them. And the damage that trying to do what I thought I needed to do in that alcoholic household took so many parts, ways, and they keep, more will be revealed to us, just like you, you know. It doesn't change with the program you're in. It really doesn't. The kids have gone on to do bigger and better things, and there were times I remember seeing in my living room, looking at that family, drinking in his lounge chair, talking to the television, which wasn't turned on, and he still does that. I just don't pay attention. And my mother on a little walker, you know, and she's supposed to be walking better by now, and I couldn't seem to do the right thing to get her to do that. And that oldest daughter of ours trying to feed us to keep us happy. I think we probably felt better when she fed us brownies, but we didn't know why. And our son loaded on something most of the time. He wasn't bobbing, by the way, like Cliff thinks. That's what Cliff saw it, because his was bobbing. And the kids have heard him say that, and he said, "Dad, David wasn't bobbing around." And he said, "He was to me." And he said, "Well, no doubt, you know, we were all bobbing to him." But he was, you know, I knew he was into this bad stuff. And the angry 14-year-old daughter, who was so angry when you walked in the room with her, you could feel it. And our little 10-year-old, tow-headed, talented little boy who could keep our family smiling for a little while, his dad laughing. If he stood on a chair and sang with an Irish accent, he could do any of that stuff at 10. And he would sing Edelweiss because he'd helped his father direct the Sound of Music up at the school. And if you ever heard Edelweiss in an Irish accent, it's kind of weird. But he'd do that. He'd sing it over and over, and he'd keep checking on his dad, and dad would smile, and he'd keep singing it over and over. And little Mary, who was 7 when we got here, and Mary had found a place for herself where she took care of herself. Every time we rearranged our rooms, we always put one couch on an angle, and Mary put her stuff behind that couch, and Mary, that's where Mary stayed. We always thought, we called it Mary's Corner. Mary had her own little place to go. And she sat in there and played with her things and listened to John Denver's little tape of In My Box. If you haven't heard that for a while, dig it out. It's quite interesting that that was the lyric she was listening to. And Mary didn't bother anybody, and she didn't try to fix us like the others were all doing. She just stayed clear of it. And Mary, she's had some struggles. She didn't go to the program for her help. She got it elsewhere, but she feels that she was strongly affected by our, you know, what went on in our family. And many people relate to when I talk about Mary in her corner, because it was safe for her. And you see, I didn't have to do much with that. She didn't require much. I'd get up in the morning and find she slept there. And all I would be is just one less thing I had to worry about. And those are the things that I had to forgive myself for, and to change and make amends to those children by changing my behavior. Because sitting down and telling them you're sorry is fine, but changing my behavior was what mattered. And I was so grateful that I could do that, and so grateful for the strength and the ongoing, nonstop support. I've gone and sat in a hospital room with my 4-year-old grandson, with my daughter who was couldn't keep her body clean and sober. She talks about this, or I would not. She talks about it from the podium. I'm sure Debbie knows about this. And that little guy was badly affected and had a lot of trouble his first few years because his mother's body wasn't clean and sober. And she knew that, and she would sit there with him, and I would sit there with her, and I knew the pain she was in. She would have to leave for a while, and I knew what she had to do when she left. She had to smoke a joint or have a drink, you know. And my heart went out to her to see her in that much pain, and I knew I couldn't do it for her. I couldn't do it for her. Well, Cliff and I don't agree all the time on the way things, we want to do things. But we do agree that we each have a right to do what's right for us. We do agree on that. And most of the time, it works pretty well. When David was in an emergency room nearby, dying, the emergency room doctor told my daughter. He's never nearby. He's usually in Africa or someplace like that. And he was dying. The doctor said his blood count's over 4.0. I don't know if he's going to make it through. My daughter and I said, let's go up there. And Cliff didn't think I should. But you see, I needed to go. And it was his not to. It was his choice, because it could look like a rescue mission to some people. I knew it wasn't, because I have my Al-Anon. I knew I was going up to say goodbye to my son, tell him I loved him. I wasn't going up there with any hope that I was going to cure him by then. And you know, I remember going up there and telling him I loved him. And as you heard, he didn't die. He hasn't had a drink since then. And he would email me soon after that. And he'd say, Mom, I hope I never see that look on your face again. I didn't go up there to show him the look on my face, but that's what he saw. And I remember asking him, I said, well, I hope you don't either, you know. But you know, the guidance of this program comes from my best heart, and I believe today that if I do what's right for me in my heart, it's going to be right for the people I love. And sometimes they don't agree, and sometimes they do. But I know in my heart now, and I get guidance still, and always will, I believe, from a good sponsor, and the ongoing work in this program has brought me to a place of pretty darn good life, I'll tell you. And who would have thought that I would be able to give up all that managing, for one thing. I went back to school, by the way, and did all those things we do, and got the right kind of education to use that psychology stuff, make money with it, you know, instead of managing alcoholics. Sometimes I'll get somebody in my office and they're an alcoholic, and I'm trying to get them to go to AA, because, you know, I can tell it right away. And so I'll say, I think you need to go to some AA meetings, and I don't think I need that. I said, well, tell you what you do. If you go to 3 AA meetings this week, you won't have to pay me for the next therapy session. And so they'll do that, you know, saves the And you know, when they come back, and it happens every once in a while, they say, you know, I don't think I need therapy. And I'll say, that's right. Up you go to AA. So I don't get rich, folks, because I'm sending everybody out there. But you know, I'm supposed to be doing that. And it's so much fun. It was so much fun. Imagine an Al-Anon getting paid to manipulate an alcoholic. It's the best of all worlds, you know, best of all worlds. I thank you so much again for inviting us, and just to see you all and see some of the good friends we've had over many, many years. And I just thank you one more time for being the people you are in my life. Thank you.